And I'm the director of the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm very pleased to be here today as a part of this panel. Scott and Tara are the preeminent researchers in the field of MRSA and animals, looking to see the prevalence and the health implications of prevalence in animals and our continent. And of course, Paul is a real pioneer in production systems, pig production systems, that not only don't need antibiotics, but have a host of other environmental impacts as well. I'd like to speak today to the policy, some of the policy opportunities that are out there to limit antibiotic use in agriculture. I want to start by, of course, making my presenter disclosure. We do not, I don't have any financial relationships with any commercial interests. But I'd just like to summarize the earlier presentations by saying that we can see by listening to Scott and Tara that the issue of MRSA is a complicated one in many ways. There are a lot of questions about where MRSA of various strains arose, whether it's moving from animals to humans, from humans to animals. And all of these details are important for designing interventions. But we also need to kind of step back and remember the fundamentals. You don't develop antibiotic resistance unless you use antibiotics. So the most fundamental approach to tamping down the pressure in microbial ecosystems to develop antibiotic-resistant traits is to control use. And in particular, you want to look at reducing unnecessary uses. Now, although today we're focused on animal use, I want to be clear that this principle applies across the board. Wherever antibiotics are used, in human medicine, in veterinary medicine, in food animal production, the first line of attack is to look for the unnecessary uses and eliminate them. In food animal production, the focus of our talks here today, that means you want to reduce the unnecessary use of those antibiotics that are medically important to humans. That means antibiotics that are used in both human and animal medicine. In terms of, and I would point out that there are other antibiotics available for veterinary use in addition to the ones that are used in humans. In terms of what are the unnecessary uses, most certainly the widespread use for growth promotion, for feed efficiency, and routine disease prevention are those that are excellent candidates for unnecessary use. We don't need to use valuable antibiotics to produce those kinds of ends. Why not? Because we need those antibiotics to work. We need to extend the use of the valuable antibiotics we have. There are virtually no new antibiotics in the pipeline. We want to prevent human suffering. Antibiotic-resistant diseases are often more virulent than their susceptible counterparts. And of course, we want to save on health costs. People for whom doctors have to go through one, two, or three antibiotics, those folks stay in the hospital a lot longer and are a greater burden in terms of costs. So we would think that there would be an effort underway to limit these non-essential uses of antibiotics, and in fact, there really hasn't been. Over the last 20 years, you could say that, FDA, with one exception, simply would not try to cancel the approvals for the existing uses of antibiotics for these inessential purposes like growth promotion. In addition, the FDA did have another problem, and that is that its enabling statute, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, made it very difficult for the agency to take a drug off the market because there are so many opportunities for drug companies to appeal. But those were two big obstacles to achieving a policy objective. Just to just to illustrate that, I'd like to point to a letter that the FDA wrote to Alpharma in 2004. And I'll translate it. It says that the outcome of a risk assessment that was done was that the product, penicillin, it's a penicillin manufacturer, is considered category one. That means it's important to human medicine. And the agency also said that production claims for increased rate of gain and improved feed efficiency are not considered appropriate for these important products. It then went on to ask the company to please, if it had any information indicating that resistance was not developing to penicillin, please provide it to the FDA. Well, the companies didn't even bother to respond. Not Alpharma or not several other similarly situated companies, because they knew that FDA wasn't going to do anything, even though FDA had done a risk assessment and decided that these were inappropriate uses. They didn't have to take FDA seriously. That led a lot of people to consider a legislative solution, the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, or PAMTA. This statute would require that the non-therapeutic uses of antibiotics be reviewed, be looked at to see whether they posed a resistance threat. And if they were, as a result of that review, determined not to be safe, it provided a streamlined path off the market that kind of cut down on the number of appeals that could increase the time it would take to get a drug off the market so that it would no longer be driving levels of resistance. There's a lot that the FDA can do even without kind of new legislation. One is that FDA could start requiring prescriptions for antibiotic use in feed animals. Right now, anybody who wants to dress to kind of lace feed with antibiotics for food animals in the U.S. can do so without requiring a prescription. The agency could also simply quit approving human use antibiotics, those used in human medicine, for widespread animal use. I mean, we do not need any more new approvals of that sort, and also could limit inappropriate extra-label uses. In veterinary medicine, just as in human medicine, veterinarians are allowed to use products for uses other than those on the labels, and in most cases, it's a wise kind of policy. But in the case of antibiotics, there are some extra label uses that are so inappropriate that that the FDA has determined that they should be specifically banned. Okay, in terms of approving new antibiotics for widespread animal use, there was an application made to the FDA about 3 years ago to improve fourth generation cephalosporin for widespread use in cattle for bovine respiratory disease. The agency has been sitting on the application for about 3 years now. An advisory committee has recommended against approval. It is time for the FDA to kind of complete that process and definitively reject that application. On the extra label use issue that I've just discussed, the FDA did determine that in the specific case of third and fourth generation cephalosporins, these drugs that are so important for human medicine, that they were not, that all of the extra label drug uses should be banned. And that included primarily the in ovo injection of eggs with cephalosporins, as it's a common industry practice. The agency decided on the basis of accumulated scientific evidence that ban should be instated a little more than a year ago, but rescinded the ban right at the end of the Bush administration, and it still has not reinstated the ban. Okay, we now have new leadership at FDA and new energy in Congress that I think provide a new atmosphere within which some of these policies that have been stalled so long, you know, might go forward in the near future. In particular, the commissioner and the deputy commissioner of the FDA, Margaret Hamburg and Joshua Sarfstein, are both individuals with public health backgrounds, and they're both convinced of the importance of the resistance issue. They are also now kind of learning the ropes in agriculture so that they will be in a position to kind of move policies ahead in this realm as well as in the human drug realm, which is also under their charge. To show you that new people do make a difference, within about 2 months of their coming on board, there was a hearing in on the Hill on the antibiotic issue. Deputy Commissioner Sharfstein appeared at the hearing and announced that the agency would seek to ban routine uses of antibiotics in farm animals in hopes of reducing the spread of dangerous bacteria. This was a stunning announcement. As I said, nothing like this has come out of the agency in the last 30 years. There's also a lot of new energy in Congress around the issue. There's now 70 plus co-sponsors, which is just amazing in the House. I think five, now six. Are we up to six in the Senate? And we're beginning to get action, like the hearing that was held in the Rules Committee this past summer. To give you an idea of the momentum, after the unfortunate passing of Senator Kennedy, many people wondered who would take up the cause of PAMPTA in the Senate. And in fact, Dianne Feinstein, who's a very powerful senator, has said that she will lead in the Senate on this issue. A kind of testament of momentum coming from the other side is the fact that the chair of the House Agriculture Committee, Colin Peterson, is so concerned about there being action on this issue that he led a delegation senators and representatives to Denmark to look into the best documented example of kind of reduced antibiotic use in agriculture, in particular in pork and poultry operations in Denmark. Now, he didn't look at it, he didn't go to learn and to be inspired. He went to kind of undercut the power of the example, but nevertheless, he thought he had to go. Another sign of momentum is that Representative Slaughter has taken up the issue, and she is quite a powerhouse of energy and action, and she now feels that she can take on ag interests in the name of the public health, and has done that, even taking on Senator Grassley from Iowa. So there are many hurdles going forward. The agriculture industry, particularly on the Hill, continues to be immensely powerful, and really whatever it doesn't want is very hard to accomplish. We've also gotten wind of some of the FDA's plans to withdraw drugs that we're afraid might be too far to the voluntary side and perhaps too narrow. And then we also just have the problem that there is so much else going on in Congress that it is really difficult to break through with an issue like this. But nevertheless, there are policy opportunities going forward. A new agenda at FDA, I believe, should include supporting PAMPTA, requiring prescriptions for animal antibiotics, reinstating the extra label use ban on third and fourth generation cephalosporins, and rejecting the bovine use of fourth generation cephalosporins. And if we were to have movement on all of these fronts, we would be able to kind of take a bite out of use. And while that would not solve the problem completely, that would certainly be an enormous step in the right direction. So thank you very much. I think all of us would be glad to answer questions. Are you going to come up and moderate?
I can help just pick
okay.
Back.
Great.
David?
So several years ago, APHA adopted a new policy that basically said it was a policy in favor of not building new confinement production facilities for animals until we have better proactive evidence that those confinement facilities are safe. And it sounds from the presentations to me like we're not there yet, but there's a lot of uncertainty about whether this routine antibiotic use or the traveling of, or creation of MRSA reservoirs in the farm, just a lot of concern, but also incomplete evidence. So I'd be interested in the panelists' reflections on that question. Can we say that confinement facilities are safe?
I think I'll let our two scientists address that first, and then I'd be willing to make a comment as well. And Paul might like want to chime in.
Well, I think the question of safe, what does safe mean? Like, there is no safe interaction. Me shaking your hand is associated with disease risk. Me having a pet is associated with disease risk. And I think that's an area that it's kind of an off-topic issue is we forget the impact of companion animals on this. We're using much more routine use of fluoroquinolones, carbapenems, various other things in the pet population we have closer contact with. So it's just a broader dynamic. When it comes to our companion, our concentrated animal facility safe, what does safe mean, I guess? And safe has to include workers, has to include their indirect contacts, has to include the environment, and has to include food safety, and also has to build in animal welfare. So, and I don't work within the industry, so I don't know if I can say that. Certainly zoonotic diseases occur associated with animal production and certainly occur associated with food. What is the role of confinement in that on the both positive and aspects of different areas? I don't know if we have a good enough set of data to say anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a hugely difficult question. You know, and right now we're again, concentrating on this one little tiny niche of that. And even if we find that this is moving from, you know, certainly the workers potentially are at risk right now, and if we find that's moving out to the general community via the air or via transmission, you know, secondary transmission from these humans, I mean, I don't know if that's enough to declare that unsafe. I think it does depend on that definition, and that's again only one small factor of all of this. So I don't know what the, you know, I'm not familiar with the APHA.
Can I ask it? Well, it seems like from the data that was presented and Paul Willis's example, that we've at least got two different ways to raise animals, and that one of them doesn't involve antibiotic use, which would seem to be a safer way to go. I don't know, so I agree it's difficult to say this one's safe, this one's not safe, but we have some criteria for thinking about what's safer, both in terms of worker conditions for workers and conditions for animals, and also this critical aspect of antibiotic use.
Yeah, I don't think there's an answer to it. Like, we look at the one farm we did with the antibiotic-free farm, that's a confinement operation. It's a small, kind of maybe your typical Ontario one, but it can be done with antibiotics. I think multiple areas, and this is beyond my expertise, and Paul could probably say a lot more, but it comes down to ability to raise animals humanely, but also ability to do it safely for the animals, too. So disease has to be taken care of, and you can't just say no antibiotics, continue the production systems the way they are, and do humane operation of agriculture, potentially. Antibiotics can't be used as a crutch to poor management. But there also has to be a middle ground there. It's just so many different areas that I don't know where you start with it, really. Yeah.
Did you want to say something, Paul?
Well, as you know, David, these confinement operations are known for externalizing their costs, whether it's safety to workers or people who work for it or their neighbors or whatever it is, you know, and that's how they exist. And American Public Health Association made this statement a few years ago. I mean, others have made similar statements and basically been ignored. The industry is very strong, very powerful, and you know, like in Iowa, we've been some kind of local control for even placement of CAFOs and so forth for many years, and nothing has been done. So, you know, you got big agricultural interests here, and a lot of these things are just being ignored. But the more people that really pay attention to it and the groundswell and everything, I mean, it's got to help. Seem to be making a little progress.
So from an outsider's viewpoint, the main way I think this is going to happen is public pressure. And the problem is, is the public more concerned about this, or are they more concerned about cheap food? Mm-hmm. And can there be a balance between this? Can you achieve the same degree of production at the same cost? And I don't know that, but I think that it's got to be a grassroots thing if you're going to make any major movement, because you said the industry has powerful lobbies, government has different things to answer to.
Pardon?
It's beyond me.
I agree. I would just point out that the externalized risks of the CAFOs allow these products to be cheaper than they ought to be. If they had to actually deal with the environmental and health costs associated with the facilities, the cost structure and the cost choices would look a lot different.
I mean, geese do land on my pasture from time to time, but they don't really co-mingle with the pigs.
They don't even pick food. We have problems with the starlings more than waterfowl coming up around the feeding platforms and eating pig food.
I just really don't worry about it.
But again, okay. So now you have MRSA, but now you have a mixing vessel to get an avian for the little pig to where we are today.
Well, I mean,
I'm not against it. I love free-range pigs, and I've eaten free-range pigs, and they are way tastier.
Yeah.
I'll take a garbage pig over the combined stuff any day. But you have to, when you make these statements like, you know, let's not allow confinement housing, well, then what other things are you opening up? You have to look at the whole picture.
Up until recently, the way we're doing it, we actually raised, and the thing is, well, you know, we have to feed everybody. In 1915, we raised more pigs, and they're all raised outdoors at that time. Of course, there were a lot of smaller farms and, you know, smaller operations, but it's been done, you know, and I don't know if we probably had the 1918 pandemic and so forth.
But, yeah, who knows?
You know, there are all of those kinds of things, and you know, but diversity, I think, is a good thing, and there's nothing like disinfectant, like the sun, and you know, plenty of fresh air and things like this.
Yeah, and diversity does play a role too. We're finding that we're having problems with certain diseases and genetic problems,
Yeah. You don't feed garbage, by the way.
Yeah, another,
we
that is
any meat products.
Another issue.
But it is an outdoor.
Yeah, I'm just going. Back, yeah?
We have one published in PLOS One in January. The others are all either submitted or we're working on writing them up. No, there was one that was published in January in the journal PLOS One. PLOS One, Public Library of Science.
Oh. PLOS, yeah.
Question over here.
So a question for Scott and Tara. You both stated that you didn't have any significant financial relations with industry firms, yet you both disclosed funding from the Pork Producers Council, which sounds to me like an industry lobbying firm. So could you explain that connection and so-called insignificance to your research?
I didn't have to start with that. Yeah, I'll take my basic. Well, the way research goes is someone pays for it, and I get a very small percentage of my funding from industry. So I do get some, and I get it from industry because if I can't get it from industry, I often can't get it from anyone else. And I think actually, I don't want to be an apologist for industry, but I actually commend the pork industry on this more than some of the other industries for addressing it, because the situation we had 3 years ago is we knew MRSA was an issue in Europe. We had no evidence of it being in North America at all. I went to Ontario Pork with a grant proposal and basically said to them, if we find it, there's going to be problems for you. But we want to know because we want to know to keep your producers safe, and we want to know if this is an early problem we could get on it. And they gave me funding, and we found it. And they took a lot of bad press over it. And I think National Pork has done the same thing, because when you're dealing with a new and emerging disease, finding it means you're going to have problems. And everyone could have easily said, let's not fund any MRSA research, let's not fund Clostridium difficile research in too many areas, and we'd be blissfully unaware, and maybe permanently, maybe 5 years from now, though, when this epidemic hits in people, if it does hit, we'd be stuck with a situation where we had no background information. So I'm not trying to sound defensive here, but I don't think there is a conflict between taking money from industry and an unrestricted grant where this is what I want to do, give me the money, I'll give you a report at the end. There's no information withheld. There's no, none of the grants I've ever had with industry, no grant I've ever had with anyone would have a clause saying I couldn't publish anything or I have to run it by them or I have to get any approval.
That's the key.
Yeah, it's completely independent. They're giving us the money, but I think it's...
And I just want to add that the Union of Concerned Scientists Keep Antibiotics Working, as soon as the information came over, as soon as we became aware of the situation in Europe, we went to the USDA and to the FDA and said, you should sponsor surveillance research, pigs and people to see what the state of MRSA is in the United States. And we got no interest at all.
Research like this, nobody wants to give it a home because it's zoonotic, so the human health people say, come back when you have, clinical cases. The animal health people say, well, it's not causing disease in pigs, so why is this our responsibility? FDA, is this in meat? USDA, is this in meat? It's a difficult place to find funding. And so our relationship with the Pork Board is pretty much the same as Scott. We applied for a grant. They funded it. They don't have, we don't have any restrictions. I'm here. Free and able to talk about any of my results. Obviously, we keep them posted with what we find, but we don't have any restrictions on publication, or they don't have any oversight into our study design or anything like that. So,
if I could just add on something. Now, that is important to know that there aren't restrictions on disclosure, but doesn't it seem logical that if you publish findings that hurt their business, you're unlikely to receive funding from them in the future? So, would that play into your choice of funding?
Multiple grants, right?
I'd say not at all, because I published the first one with Ontario Pork, and I've been funded by multiple agencies since then. The other thing is, this is a small component of my research, really. If all the pork industry cut me off because they don't like what I say, then I still have a career, so it's not the only thing that I do. I really have no concerns about being cut off by any industry groups, and I'm quite happy to say whatever I want. We publish things that are very clear. I think we say exactly what we feel. We raise the concerns, we raise issues about MRSA in production, whether antibiotics might be used or may not be a source, whether this may or may not be a risk, but I think we're saying what we think is there, and we're traveling around a lot saying things that raise questions that the pork industry has to address.
I agree.
Do you have to take another question or two?
No, could you please just repeat your question?
Yeah, the question is, what's the economics here of doing of a CAFO versus an open field operation? The second part of that question is, corn subsidies play into that at all?
The answer to the second question is, you bet. You can argue that a lot of confinement systems are in many ways driven by the fact that we have so much corn and we need something to do with it. I mean, I personally know some folks who are spending all of their time in the Far East promoting confinement pig and poultry operations. And I said, who's paying you to do that? You know, is it the U.S. pork industry? No, it's the corn folks and the soybean folks. They understand that these systems are dependent on grain, and finding markets for that grain is part of their agenda. So it certainly is a part of it. And I mean, I will say that the general the answer to the very important big question, why do we have CAFOs now, when, as Paul said, we don't really need them to produce enough pigs. We could easily produce the same number of pigs we're producing in confinement without confinement. And that's true in beef and poultry as well. But what does drive it? And the Union of Concerned Scientists wrote an interesting study called CAFOs Uncovered, yes. And we try to kind of lay out some of those things. And it's a complicated set of factors, and it's driven at least in part by processors who have captive market supplies. There's an antitrust component, there's a market control component. But it's interesting that what doesn't drive it really is the efficiency, the kind of costs of production of pigs medium-sized farms. The cost of production for outdoor and confined production are quite comparable.
Paul, do you want to add?
Did you want to add to that?
Well, the CAFO system is a highly capitalized. You know, you've got a $500,000 building or something like this. Hired labor. It is really a factory kind of a setup. Now, the interesting thing is the last year or two, corn has become expensive. It's primarily driven by the ethanol craze. And the interesting thing is that now, you know, CAFOs are competing for the same bushel of corn that ethanol is competing with. So prior to the ethanol situation, corn was really cheap. You could buy it actually cheaper than you could raise it. And corn growers, I'm a corn grower, I grow some corn myself, basically consume it on my own farm, but corn production was subsidized, and the formula is such that now corn prices have gone up primarily because of ethanol, so the corn producers are getting it in the marketplace as opposed to from subsidies from the government, not as many subsidies as they were. Our farmers are more diversified. Raising pigs like this is an enterprise on a diversified farm. You know, a lot of our farmers have other kinds of livestock. They're raising, you know, different crops and this kind of thing. So anyway, that's a big difference.
It is a complicated question with a complicated answer.
It costs us, we have to make more per pig. Pigs. One of those buildings holds more than what I raise in a year.
But I would just point out that for corn production in this country, whether prices are sky high, which they were a couple years ago, or low, the corn farmers get government subsidies on top of whatever they get in the marketplace.
Well, the CAFOs typically are, I mean, they might be owned by Smithfield. We have a neighbor, they sold a piece of land, and then they put up a building, put the pigs in, put the feed in. They hire the neighbor's boy to run the operation. He works in the CAFO building. You know, so most hogs raised in CAFOs today are not owned by farmers. They're owned by, you know, probably the top 5 or 10 large companies own most of the pigs.
We'll take one more quick question. Right here.
Some farmers that owned their own confinement operation, and I was just telling you, this one family, they were really depressed and they were discouraged. I mean, they literally never wanted to go in that building again.
Yeah.
And they heard about this, and the guy came and saw me, and we showed a picture of that, those pigs in a kind of a winter setting with a farrowing. He said, that's not that difficult. He took $80,000 and changed his building. And changed it into a bedded system, and he's now a Nyman farmer. It's not all that common, but it has been done, and it can be done. And you know, it's totally changed their attitude about raising livestock and what they do on their farm. They see a future.
And wouldn't that be a good use of some of this government subsidy money in agriculture to enable farmers who wanted to change to do so, rather than to just continue to kind of add money to corn farmers, driving up production?
That seems like a good place to wrap. I know I saw more hands, but I think the presenters will be able to stick around for a few more minutes. If you have questions, you can come on up to the front. Thank you all for coming. Oh, and I think I forgot to mention, I do have bio sheets on all the presenters back in the back of the room, as well as I think there's some additional information from the Union of Concerned Scientists on this issue.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming.